Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. It's always great to have David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker and host of The New Yorker Radio Hour, on the show. David joins us today with a preview of the New Yorker Festival coming up this weekend and his take on some topics of particular interest to him in the news, especially Russia's war in Ukraine. David, if you don't know, has written two books about Russia and was a Washington Post correspondent stationed there for 4 years. David also has a recent piece calling for a Nobel Prize for Salman Rushdie. Maybe you even heard his New Yorker Radio Hour interview with Roger Federer, recently re-aired on the occasion of the tennis great's retirement. So who knows what might come up. David, it is always great to have you on the show. Happy October.
Oh, it's great to talk to you and Happy New Year to you.
And listeners, you get to ask David Remnick a question. Anything you always wanted to ask the New Yorker editor and New Yorker Radio Hour host, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Can we start with the fun stuff? Start the meal with dessert, and you'll tell us a little about the New Yorker Festival coming up this weekend. And maybe for the uninitiated, what is the New Yorker Festival?
Well, the New Yorker Festival is something that we started, you know, more than 20 years ago. And it's a weekend-long festival of discussion and politics and the arts and performance and comedy and really a three-dimensional version of what we do in the magazine and on the website every day and every week. And, you know, like everybody else these past couple of years, we've had to do things virtually. And, you know... That has its limits in so many ways. And what's wonderful about this year's festival is we are back on stage. We are back in three dimensions. And there are tickets left. And, you know, we're selling quite well, but there are still many, many events that your listeners can certainly buy tickets to, whether it's a discussion with Susan Laurie Parks, the great playwright, or Ben Stiller, where some of the people that have been on Saturday Night Live over the years who are talking with Susan Morrison. There's any number of events that you still have access to, and you can get them all at newyorker.com/festival. So I'm really excited for this weekend.
And I see that your featured interview on stage will be with Bono. Why Bono?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, a few months ago, I was sitting right here at this desk at home working on a Sunday, and I get a call on my cell phone. It's Bono. Now, I got to tell you, Brian, I have a lot of lucky accidents.
Now you're just name dropping, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's kind of a trip. And he said, you know, I finished this book, and would you like to read it? I said, absolutely, sure. And he said, well, you know, I think you live, you know, not so terribly far from me. He was in New York. Why don't you come over? And so within an hour, I found myself in Bono's apartment with him reading me a couple of chapters from this extraordinary memoir that he's just written. So as you know, maybe a couple of weeks ago, we published an excerpt from Bono's book, and I'll be interviewing him Friday evening at Ethical Culture.
And by the way, for people who have very strong backpacks or book bags and want to read more than the New Yorker published excerpt, this memoir I see is 576 pages.
Well, it's been a rich life. What can I say? Guess. It's been a rich life, yeah.
And it's actually a little coup that I think that you have him this weekend at the festival, because usually we have a lot of experience with this. Authors won't talk about their books until the release date, which is in November. So he will go there with you this weekend?
Well, you know, I guess I got in on the ground floor for once in my life. So that's nice. You're absolutely right. You know, we've done this with other musicians. I've interviewed Bruce Springsteen and Patti Smith, and we've done any number of musicians at the festival. Sometimes they even play. So you never know.
Does Bono want to talk these days more about politics and philanthropy or more about music?
Well, I think this book is so built around his life that our conversation will certainly start out about what I always find the most fascinating thing in any memoir is how somebody becomes themselves, you know, how they create themselves. And that's, you know, the case with, you know, Bob Dylan's Chronicles or Springsteen's Born to Run, and all kinds of memoirs. I always find that incredibly fascinating. You know, they don't start out with even the same name, and they just start out with a little, some talent and a dream and accident. And I want to get into that with Bono. I'm sure we'll talk about politics because that's part of what he cares about so much. But certainly what puts him on the public stage in the beginning and keeps him there is this extraordinary musical talent.
On politics, you know, he gets it plenty from the right, but also sometimes from the left. Like, he's been criticized for doing photo ops with George W. Bush and Mike Pence, and also for giving credibility to other Christian right figures, and occasionally for making Africa look like it needs white Western saviors, you know. So is he politically complex as you see him, or should I wait till after the weekend to ask you that question?
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think when it comes to George Bush, it's not his it's in any way supporting a lot of Bush's foreign policy. I think the feeling about Bush comes from PEPFAR and AIDS. And I think on that one issue, they are very aligned, and with good reason.
Yeah. So looking at the rest of the list for the New Yorker Festival, one of the things I noticed is that you've got a good helping of comedy this year. Maybe you always do. But you mentioned the Saturday Night Live alum. I see you have Hasan Minhaj and Phoebe Robinson together, Jared Carmichael. And I mean, comedy isn't all a lot of these people do, but their little bios in your press release mention comedian for all of them. You want to make people laugh at the New Yorker Festival because the world is giving us so many reasons to cry these days?
Yeah, the world is too much with us. But look, there's plenty of politics and serious literature and all kinds of things. And even the comedy, too, is inflected with politics of a kind. So, you know, look, comedian and filmmaker Jared Carmichael, who's talking with Andrew Marantz, he, you know, brought his own coming out into the clear as part of his, not only part of his act, but also part of his, the way he deals with the world. And I think that will be at the center of their discussion, not just jokes. Jokes have their political valence too.
Is it an issue in editing the magazine these days, the seriousness of our times? Like, there seem to be so many political and cultural emergencies that you have new judgments to make as an editor compared to 10 years ago or more about how much you can put in there that's just really interesting or just really funny?
I think it would be incredibly irresponsible, even if I can say this, immoral, for the New Yorker to overlook all the serious issues that face us. And I don't mean just, you know, an average election. I mean existential issues like what we face environmentally. So that's why we have Betsy Colbert and Bill McKibben and others just hammering away at this and dedicating their writing lives to writing about this on a deep level. The same goes with the war in Ukraine. We've had several correspondents going in and out of Ukraine. And look, I'm not a fool. I know that sometimes dessert is more popular than, as you call it. But I want to look back at what the New Yorker wrote about and accomplished and got to the depths of with some sense of pride that we engaged our times properly and with all our might. And we do it. It's enormously expensive and really risky having correspondents in the center of a war. But I couldn't be prouder of Luke Mogelson, Masha Gessen, Josh Yaffa, Ed Caesar. People have, you know, the photographers that have gone with him and all the rest. I'm aware. I'm not, you know, that maybe on a given week, that's not the most, you know, traffic or whatever. I don't care. It's important. And those people it affects them deeply. You know, people ask me about fiction too. The magazine comes in parts, and different parts of the magazine and the site appeals to different people and at different levels. The people that read the fiction, for some of them, it's the most important part of the New Yorker, and so therefore it's important to me. So if we just aim for popularity and what the highest number will read, and we can now track these things online, I think we would diminish the New Yorker in every sense. It's not what we're here on earth to do.
We'll continue in a minute with David Remnick, including taking your calls for him, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. In fact, I see the caller on line one has the same first question I was going to ask you after the break about whether, well, I'm going to save it for after the break. And Janet in Brooklyn, I'm going to let you do it. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with New Yorker magazine editor, New Yorker Radio Hour host here on the station, and previewer of the New Yorker Festival live on stage around town this weekend, David Remnick, and Janet in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hey, Janet, thanks for calling in today.
Good morning. I was just talking with my son about the war in Ukraine, and I was saying that you have to stop fascism. And I wonder if the draft going on in Russia right now, maybe the Russian people will be more aware of the war and maybe push Putin to stop the war sooner. But dictators are usually not very smart. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. David,
well, Janet,
and for people who don't know, David has a big Russia expertise. He's been stationed there as a reporter in the past and written two books on Russia. So what do you think? Is the draft going to be Putin's undoing?
You know, the difficulty there, and Janet asks the million-dollar question or the million-billion-ruble question, is that as bad as politics are here, and it is bad, and we are in a struggle against authoritarian leaders and inclinations that we see all over our society in the political scene. We're in a real struggle. That shouldn't be discounted any day. But in Russia, you have authoritarianism solidly in power. And as a result, you don't have politics as we understand it. So one man who's created this system in the last 20 years that depends entirely on his say-so, on his power and his circle, it's very uncertain how that gets changed other than him dying, to be frank. How he would possibly get overturned, who would take over for him, is something that is almost a black box. It's very hard to see into that if we're being honest with ourselves. So yes, there are thousands and thousands of Russian families and young men who don't want to have any part of conscription, that do not want to fight this war. But at the same time, you have to understand that the official channels of information, mainly television, are flooded with a kind of propaganda that makes, it's Fox News on steroids, to put it lightly. It's very hard to penetrate that. Even in communist times, when Khrushchev was overthrown in the mid-60s, there was actual politics in the Soviet leadership. It was invisible to most of us, but it did exist. You don't have that kind of leadership now. It's so centered on one person.
The draft that the caller referred to is not quite a draft, as I understand it. It's calling up 300,000 reservists, however, who may have thought they were done with any kind of frontline service. And one stat that I heard this weekend is that 200,000 Russian men have left the country since the call-up announcement of those 300,000 reservists to help fight the war in Ukraine. I mean, 200,000 Russian men as an exodus, if that's really happening, and the protests that are breaking out in multiple Russian cities, you think they're all for nothing?
No, there's a huge degree of chaos in Russia right now, and you're also seeing people, voices getting on television and on Telegram, the encrypted app Telegram, that are very angry at Putin, but they're not. Those are not voices that you would like, Brian. Certainly not ones that I would like. These are voices from his right, who think that Russia should, go all the way, as it were, even use tactical nuclear weapons. Yeah. Now, people on his left, so to speak, have either left the country, are in jail, or are silenced. And so when, you know, a dissident writes about Putin's failures from a human rights point of view, from a point of view of a democratic voice, that article tends to appear in the Washington Post or elsewhere in the Western press, not in the Russian press.
But are you saying that the demonstrations in the streets around Russia now are go big, nuke Kyiv if you have to, kinds of demonstrations?
No. I'm not saying that. The demonstrations that we've seen have been anti-draft. The demonstrations we've seen are anti-draft, and the people that are doing that are showing enormous courage. I'm talking about official media. Official media, and a lot of what appears in these encrypted apps is something else. It's come to Putin's so-called right.
Jack in Rockland County, a retired Marine, you're on WNYC, who says his wife is from Russia. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for taking my call. I've called in several times. How in the world did you know I was a retired Marine? I don't think I said that, but my.
Oh, I don't know.
Thank you.
Maybe you said it to my screener.
maybe I did, but thank you. I've got a question for you, guest. I've traveled to Russia several times over the last decade. Was blown away by how rich and beautiful the culture is. And me and my wife, after 17 years, she hadn't been back. We thought Putin was incredible, the things he was doing. But of course, now a different story. We're horrified. Question: sometimes in warfare, you have to concede. And I think I heard over the weekend that Putin was kind of grudgingly, willingly, maybe going to go to the bargaining table if Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, would go there. Of course, they are angry and will be angry for the next 1,000 years. Sometimes you have to concede. And I thought a viable option for the Ukrainians would be to say, okay, you got one up on us. You can have this territory now. We're going to drop an iron curtain, join NATO, and we're going to be hostile for the next 1,000 years. Congratulations, Putin. You're encircled by NATO. Your thoughts, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Jack.
I think the Ukrainians see that as surrender. I think the Ukrainians and I think the West joins them in believing that an invasion first of Crimea, then of eastern Ukraine. Why should that territory? Why should that population be ceded to Russian power? It makes no sense, that would be tantamount to surrender.
Now this came up a lot at the beginning of the war too, where a lot of people were saying, look, he wants the eastern region where there are a lot of pro-Russia people in the population anyway, let him take that and then he'll leave the rest of Ukraine alone. And not just Zelensky, but the people of that region staunchly said no to that idea and showed how much they're willing to die to stave off that idea. I think it's been either an inspiration or at very least a lesson to people who don't know Ukraine very well for the rest of the world.
I think we make a very serious mistake if we buy into Putin's propaganda, Putin's misbegotten analysis that somehow because certain people in Ukraine speak Russian, that they are pro-Russian, that they are inviting the invasion of their own country. That is just simply not the case. We saw that kind of analysis in the 30s and in the 40s from Germany. I'm loathe to say that one thing equals another, you know, the World War II experience equals exactly this experience, but we should learn from history when that is staring us in the face.
Just to follow up on what you just said, the latest development in the war really is Ukraine recovering Limon in the eastern part of the country, that exact part where Putin claims to have won a referendum by the people to become a part of Russia. I don't know how many people actually voted or were allowed to vote honestly. Did you have an eye on that referendum, or do you think the this military development of taking back a key strategic area in the exact eastern part of the country that he thinks is more rightly his, or where he thinks he's got some popular support,
you know,
is going to matter militarily?
We hear a word like referendum, and we on our and our imaginations go to a kind of referendum on our democratic ballot when we go to vote in November. That's not what happened. Vladimir Putin and his army invaded Ukraine, seized much of eastern Ukraine, and then at the point of a gun declared that there should be a referendum on voting whether these parts of Ukraine should become part of Russia. People were forced in the ugliest way just to vote. Who was counting the votes exactly? it's a fraud. It's a fraud on the most grotesque geopolitical level. Everybody knows it. Anybody with eyes on this knows that that's the case. It's just part of a hideous chapter in Russian history. I have to say, you know, you said that I was a correspondent in Moscow. It's absolutely true. It was in the late 80s, early 90s when the world was full of possibility. It was never going to be easy for Russia to transition from 70 years of totalitarian communism and 1,000 years of absolutism to the modern world and maybe a democratic world. That was never going to be easy and smooth, and there were countless mistakes all over. But Putin has been in power for 20 years. These mistakes, these evil deeds, could put it starkly, this transition to authoritarianism or even fascism is on him. And to complicate that matter, I think, is impossible.
One other Putin question, and then I want to ask you one Salman Rushdie question, and then we're out of time. I'm curious what you think about Putin's implication recently that he would use nuclear weapons. I tend to think he would never do it, but maybe my reasoning is too logical, but you tell me. Putin wants a strong Russia. He wants a superpower Russia that competes with the West over the long term. If he dropped even the smallest tactical nuclear weapon with the horrors that would ensue, so morally acceptable to basically the whole rest of the world, he would make Russia even more of a pariah for a generation at least. But maybe he's not rational in that way. What do you think?
Well, he has threatened many things, and to our peril, we have not taken him seriously on his threats. When he was threatening to invade Ukraine this last time, even the Ukrainian leadership was not quite sure whether he was serious or whether he'd quote unquote go all the way. There's no need to kind of argue that out. I think if we fail to take his threat seriously, we do so at our incredible peril. Do I think he will? Probably not drop a nuclear weapon, but what good is, you know, what value is that for me to say probably not? None. We have to take these threats incredibly seriously, just as we would from a leader that we've grown used to thinking of as unstable in North Korea.
Give me one thought before we run out of time from your September 5th issue of The New Yorker comment. It's time for Salman Rushdie's Nobel Prize. His literary accomplishments richly merit recognition from the Swedish Academy. How much does it have to do with the fact that he was brutally attacked recently?
Well, the Swedish Academy has overlooked, you know, says countless writers of real greatness. We don't have to, you know, go through the whole list, and has made some mistakes. But prizes are prizes. There are going to be mistakes. Here's a chance to honor someone that is a writer of the most extraordinary level, beginning with Midnight's Children, his second novel. And I could name any number of other ones that I think are extraordinary. That's just my opinion. And at the same time, he has been designated for murder by the leader of a major state, the so-called fatwa. And we've now reached the point where someone has acted on it. Someone has acted on it and nearly killed Salman Rushdie on a public stage in the United States of America. The Swedish Academy foolishly did not issue a strong statement of support for Rushdie when the fatwa came out, to their everlasting shame. And I think insofar as a prize can do anything, they can honor Rushdie, who richly deserves it on every level, literary, political, moral. And the Swedish Academy could do a little to redeem itself by awarding this award. If Rushdie were not the writer he is, I wouldn't have suggested it. And I fully realize that me suggesting it is, a drop in the ocean. But I think it would be a great gesture of solidarity for the cause of freedom of speech, which has suffered all too many blows.
Well, this is Nobel Prize season. They handed out the first one today, which I think was in medicine. And the rest will follow in the coming days, including in literature. Maybe they'll actually do it. We will see. David Remnick, editor of The New Yorker, host, of course, of The New Yorker Radio Hour, weekends here on the station. And you want to tell people one more time how they can get tickets for The New Yorker Festival live on stage around town this weekend?
Well, I think if you go to our website at newyorker.com, you'll get there easily, or newyorker.com/festival. It will make it real easy for you to buy tickets.
Thanks, as always, David. Always good to talk.
Wonderful to talk to you, Brian. Thanks so much.